Yeah, sorry about
that.
Did
you get your bagel?
These guys have been nothing but jerks to you for the last 5 minutes. I swear to you.
It's true.
I could tell. Did you get your bagel? Seems like a euphemism born out of a, like, you know.
No, seriously, I've actually meant bagel this time.
Hey, guy, did you get your bagel?
I'll give you a bagel right here.
Yeah.
First, I just want to say, like I always do, everybody needs to calm the fuck down. Nolan Lawson, the guy who wrote a couple of blog posts, seems like a nice kid. And I actually talked to him briefly on Twitter this morning because somebody last night told me not to feed the trolls with this baity tweet that I did last night when I was half in the bag. And I told him that, you know, Nolan's not not a troll. He, you know, he's misinformed, but he's not a troll. So
Such a fine line.
He meant well, but seriously, those two posts really were clickbait. And he ought to know that. And as I said, they're true.
He admitted as much. He admitted that the headline was intentionally meant to stir up some conversation, which it very clearly did.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it was so uninformed that I think it stirred up the wrong conversation. And not to mention factually wrong in some cases. Nolan did take a mea culpa for some of that in his follow-up, which is nice. But the tone and misinformation there, it just adds to the bullshit about Apple, Safari, and WebKit. And, you know, Nolan said, the trailer, the epilogue on his second post, you know, I hope someone from Apple comes up, takes off a glove, and slaps me right in the face. Well, they can't do that, but motherfucker, I can. I can do that. And I think a lot of this boils down to the problem that I have. Folks like Nolan, right or wrong, see the world only through one lens, and it's really the Google or the Mozilla style lens. That's fine, but you can't expect Apple to behave that same way. And it's not wrong for Apple to behave the way that they do. It's just the way that Apple behaves. Now, after all this, some good may still come of his blog, his posts. I don't think it touched a nerve at Apple, which is what he hoped. I think if you work on Safari and WebKit or any web browser, really, you have to have a very, very thick skin. And just as an aside, before I get into this other stuff, I've told this story at NS North last year, and Renee and Guy had to listen to this in the audience. But, you know, the whole KHTML and KJS over Mozilla and Gecko choice that I made early on in the process of doing Safari, you know, I really got second-guessed often about that over the years. And not by my managers, not by Scott Forstall and his boss, Bertrand Serlet. They always supported me, bless them. And not by my staff either. They had good sense. But, you know, there were some at Apple and there were some elsewhere. You just overreacted. And before we debuted Safari to the public, you know, I was a genius before development was going so well. And then when people got their hands on Safari and realized that it wouldn't render websites exactly like Internet Explorer, I was an idiot for not choosing Mozilla. And then, you know, not that Mozilla would have been more compatible back then, you know, but. And then when we did the iPhone next, and not only does WebKit actually fit on the device, which Mozilla would not have, it's fast and it works great, and Safari is the wonder application for all mankind. So I'm back to being a genius. And then Google forks WebKit for Chrome, and I'm a fucking idiot again, because I picked this open source solution that they could do that. And, you know, Steve wasn't happy about that one. And I kept trying to explain to him I couldn't take it back. And boy, did I have to do that a lot. And then thanks to Google and others, everybody's using WebKit for things like toaster ovens and sex toys and Christ only knows what all. And we really have taken over the world. So I'm a fucking genius again. So if you work on a web browser, you're just used to this shit. It's like you have a big kick me sign taped to your backside. So touching a nerve, no. I think there's a lot of eye rolling in Cupertino, but no nerves exposed. But who knows? Maybe Darren Adler, who runs Safari and WebKit, and Maciej Stachowiak, who's in charge of all of WebKit, can use this kerfuffle, and that's all it really fucking is, to try to loosen their PR chains. And I'll explain more about that later on, what I mean by that. But to Nolan's credit, he had two good points. One is, you know, the initial implementation of IndexedDB in WebKit was incomplete, and unfortunately it was buggy. And I can talk more about that if people want, even though I wasn't there when it was done. And that WebKit is the only browser engine allowed on iOS. It's a valid point. It doesn't mean what he thinks it means in the way that he thinks. Well, my big problem with it is, you know, there's so many bad points there. First off, comparing Safari to IE, which he probably meant IE 6, is just stupid. I mean, it's like that is truly an apple and oranges thing. Safari is not a moribund monopoly, right? Which is what IE 6 was. I mean, I was one of the people, along with several folks at Mozilla, and obviously my whole team, who overturned that situation. So comparing Safari to that, even now, is just it's just stupid. And anybody who says that innovation in Safari or WebKit has stopped or slowed is just not paying attention to what's going on. I mean, you know, you've got that. You've got that lens on of seeing everything the Google way. And I'm sorry, that's not the way the real world works. So describing the Safari and WebKit team's efforts as benevolent neglect is truly insulting. And there's a good chance somebody on that team will just pop him one for that if they ever see him. Because you don't diss people like that. You don't diss their efforts. That's, you don't do that to engineers. That's uncalled for.
So how do you feel, Don?
I was really pissed off about it because not that he said it, but, you know, just, you know, kind of whiny thing. What I was pissed off was it was the usual stupid, you know, bullshit about Apple and Safari that just snowballed because it was set up as link bait. And Renee, you know very well, I mean, Jesus Christ, you know, it's not your job to be an apologist for Apple, yours or Gruber's or Dalrymple's or anything else, but Christ, the misinformation about Apple out there.
I don't look at it as apologizing for Apple. I look at it as informing the readership, because if I'm increasingly, maybe I'm just getting old and crusty, Don, but I'm increasingly looking at stuff that is badly written, that is sensationalized, and that is doomsaying, as not only bad journalism, but harmful. And I'd rather people are well informed. Like, they might think, oh, I'm missing this feature, and this feature could be a security disaster. And I'm sure we'll get to like the WebGL example and stuff, but I think people need a full picture, and whether they agree with Apple or disagree with Apple, them understanding at least some idea of what Apple's doing, I think helps inform them to make, and they can make better decisions.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about this with regarding to the misinformation is it seems like that's the position that Apple's always been in, whether they were beleaguered and a week away from going out of business. There was massive amounts of information, misinformation and FUD going around. And now that they're the most valuable company in the history of the world, they're getting the same thing just from the reverse side. And I know that Gruber's talked about this a little bit. He realized that things had changed when the feedback that he was getting went from, oh, you're such a fanboy apologist. Of course, he would say something like that to, oh, you're such a fanboy apologist, because they're on the top of the pile now. And I don't know. You know, it's like they can't win. When they're at the bottom of the pile, they're getting the slack, and when they're at the top of the pile, it's the same thing.
Yeah, it's a, and Nolan described the, he was projecting weird isolationism, he called it, about Apple and, you know, not engaging the community and stuff. Here's the thing. Let me back up. And I've talked about this before in my own podcast, and I've talked about this at Ool and Innes North. And, you know, the first rule of Fruit Club is that you don't talk about Fruit Club. And, it, you know, this is not a decision by the WebKit team. This is the legacy of Steve Jobs, you know, that asshole who ruined Apple with his stupid ideas.
I got to tell you, before we say that as a CNBC headline, Don was being sarcastic.
Oh, no, no, I was, that was dripping sarcasm. Jesus Christ. I mean, the WebKit team would love to engage the, more in public, of course, but that's not the way things are done in Cupertino. And that's, you know, and Steve had a really good damn reason for making himself, you know, the point person for all PR. I mean, when you work there, you know, you were not in a glass house at all.
Well, Steve couldn't really fire himself, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But,
Don, I'm curious about how much you see that changing now that things are, quote, different in the Tim Cook era. You know, I was in the room when Phil Schiller came on stage and sat down with John Gruber for an hour, as I think several other people were. And that just would not have happened a few years ago. And I think one of the points that this post made that I think is fair is that there is a lack of engagement with the web development community, with the open source community, that, you know, Apple could clearly be doing a better job of. And whether it's a post like this or whether it's an internal reorganization or restructuring, you know, do you guys see that changing at all?
Well, first off, I don't actually agree with that. Let's go back. I think it's the situation is thawing, but under Tim Cook, and I think it will change over time. But let's be clear. Schiller going up there was trying to give the sense of glassness. But if you listen to everything he said, you know, there was no news there. I mean, it was just him being on stage with Gruber. It's like it's a stunt.
He's
right?
Very good at his job.
And remember, it's Phil fucking Schiller up there, right? It's not, you know, the lead engineer going up and talking about that stuff. If that guy would have got on stage, you know, lead engineer, the manager of one of the projects or whatever.
Mike Federighi.
Yeah, they would have been shot. I mean, it's just, you know, it's going to take a while to get, you know, that first rule of Fruit Club bred out of them. And the Apple PR thing it's very, very tight. I mean, the contrast is, you know, I'm sure Google has more evangelists employed for Chrome than fuck Apple has for the entire WebKit team.
As for their entire company, Don. I think Apple has, exactly. You can measure them in a dozen.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, it's not Apple's business to, you know, explain what the web is, because that's not crucial to them in the same way. The web is a platform for Apple, but it's a complementary platform. It's a third platform after iOS and OS X. For Google, that is, you know, Chrome OS, that is the platform. So, of course, they're going to take that approach that way.
Okay. But
the other thing is this engaging in the public thing. This is all bullshit, and Nolan even said as much in his second post.
By bullshit, do you mean theater?
No. I meant that the WebKit team doesn't.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's not true that they don't engage.
Right. They do it all the time, but they're not. They have to do it in a way that, you know, PR isn't going to put the coital cuff on them, right? So they're doing it in mailing lists. They're doing it in chats. They're doing it in standards bodies. And, oh, by the way, here's the thing that really pissed me off.
now we're going to get mad.
Here's the thing.
So I think one of the examples that Nolan said was, you know, attending EdgeConf, his conference of the day or whatever is crucial to the participating in standards. No, I'm sorry. It's not. Participating in standards is crucial to participating in standards. And the WebKit team is all over that. I mean, does anybody remember the What Working Group? Who the fuck do you think helped found that and revive the moribund standards process? So, you know, kiss my ass if you think Apple's not involved in that stuff. That's the important thing. But they can't go to conferences like that. I'll tell you a story, and I don't want to piss off a good friend of mine, but he's sort of like involved in it about this. Years ago, I think it might have been 06 or 07 or whatever. While I was there, you know, I was director. I'd been squeezing PR and I'd been squeezing my management to get Maciej Stachowiak to be able to attend a conference on the outside. And I was probably a couple of weeks away from pulling it off so he could actually go out and talk to developers and do a presentation from Apple. This was going to be like a first. And then, unfortunately, Michael Lopp attended South by Southwest.
God.
And somebody recorded something he said. You know, it was, and Michael didn't say anything wrong.
No,
he didn't say anything incorrect. He slipped, right?
Yeah.
And that was it. That's all she wrote. I couldn't do dick, right? And
Lop
so
had an awkward meeting after that, by the way.
Yeah, he had the poor bastard. I mean, he's a really nice guy. And
yeah, super
he was
nice
just
guy.
And like I said, what he said was not wrong. And it was not even not in Apple's interest to say that. But it's like the first rule of Fruit Club is you don't talk about Fruit Club.
Yeah.
And you know what? As much as you don't like that working on an open source project at Apple, you can't argue with Steve Jobs that that doesn't work because, hey, biggest fucking company in the world, you know? So when you're just one success after another, it's really hard to argue that this new tack that they've never done in the last, you know, 18 years is going to somehow make things better. It's got to be incremental. Now, it's starting to be incremental now, but it's not really incremental by Phil going on stage with Gruber. I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of a stunt. Maybe it shows a little bit. But I tell you, when some lead engineers or some project managers or team managers, they go on stage or they talk in one of these podcasts, then you'll know they're making progress. But until that time, but also at the same time, Apple's got plenty of people involved in the standards process, right? There's also this thing where, you know, people don't, and I think Nolan did this, you know, why doesn't Apple adopt the latest and greatest web technology stuff? And so he goes on a rant about several technologies there. And people have very short memories about the kind of technologies that Apple has, one, pioneered and, you know, helped get through the standards process and continues to add. And certainly for some of those technologies, they do. And WebKit tries to lead on media, graphics, layout, certainly performance, concerns about battery life.
Accessibility.
Accessibility has always been a huge one. Because those matter to making Safari the best browsing experience on iOS and OS X. And that's your lens, by the way, making Safari the best browsing experience. But the WebKit team is actually fairly content to follow on infrastructure because things like installable web apps are not really a priority. Now, I had a conversation.
And that, I think that's the exact right point is,
yes,
you know, what are Apple's incentives and what are the pieces that are aligned with Apple's incentives? And, you know, Ben Thompson made this point. If everyone should be reading Ben Thompson's newsletter. If you're not, then there's something wrong with you. But he made this point the day after this IE post came out, which is, you know, what are the pieces that are aligned with Apple's incentives? And are Apple's incentives aligned with web developers' incentives? Kind of. Are Apple's incentives aligned with Apple's users? Much more so. And, you know, it's pretty clear that the things that they prioritize, exactly what Dom was just saying, you know, battery life on iOS, performance, media handling, those kinds of things. Those are the things that are always going to be the sort of top line elements. You know, web workers, maybe not. It's a little further down the list.
Yeah, I think you mean service workers, actually, in this case. But yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Service workers. But yeah, that's exactly it. And it's not that Apple doesn't work on those things or doesn't work on the infrastructure stuff. They've actually done proposals. I mean, one of the reasons we have service workers now is because, you know, Apple was one of at the forefront of doing the app cache in the beginning and giving people stuff. But hey, people are never fucking happy and they have short goddamn memories, don't they? So
would it be useful just to give us a brief idea of what these technologies are?
Thank you.
We're talking about.
I'll get to those in a second after I make this other.
After I stop yelling.
I have three more curse words on this list.
Would you please get off my goddamn lawn? Yeah. And then I will describe my grass.
Exactly. Yeah. But anyway, so they've installable web apps are not really a priority. But the story I was going to tell, it's not because Apple thinks it can't make money on them or something like that, but. Do you guys remember when extensions came out? What was that? 2009?
It's like 2 years ago. Extensions? Safari extensions.
Oh, yeah. I forget when the hell we did it. It's all a blur, you know.
Yeah, 2009 seems reasonable. Capable was on stage. Yeah.
Right, because you know, doing all of this, by the way, these podcasts, one of the reasons I don't do these rants most of the time is it just really interferes with my drinking. And remembering the dates and stuff is a good sign that I'm being very effective with the drinking. Cool. So
that's why we got Jim here.
Yeah. Cool. So
he's easy ice cube in here in a pure hard glass of Don Melton. We got a little ice cube in there.
Yeah. So somebody has to be sober. So when that came out, I mean, I was like, well, this is a really good idea. I wanted to do this kind of stuff for, they wouldn't let us do it for iOS because obviously we didn't have the you know, it wasn't safe. I get to the whole safety thing a little bit. I had a conversation with Brian Kroll, who's you know, one of the heads of marketing over at Apple out in the lobby of aisle 3 actually. And Brian was like, hey, this, you know, this is so cool. Maybe we should do a store. Not a conversation about extensions, but a year or two later when the whole web apps thing came out. And Brian asked me, he's like, you know, should we get into the web applications thing and, you know, whatever, maybe we can do a store. And it's like, Brian, they didn't let me do a store when extensions came out. Why the hell would you think Steve would, because Steve is still around there, they would let me do a store for this? Because it wasn't that, you know, that we couldn't sell them, but it was just a matter of focus, right? That's the web is a complementary platform. It's not a primary platform, right? And the other thing, going back to this participating in standards and doing the new cool web technology stuff, it's not that Apple doesn't care about that. I mean, hell, they got two extremely complex sites themselves, apple.com and iCloud.com. And you got to believe me that, you know, those are some really gnarly pieces of JavaScript running on those things, for one thing, and very complex presentations. But if we're going to do apps, we're probably going to do native, or we're going to do a combination of native and web, because that's what really makes sense.
So isn't that the point, though, that web is a tertiary platform, or at least a secondary platform to Apple?
So?
I mean, that's what all of the
I think that's what all the angst and the hand wringing from the open web folks is all about. And
right,
I'm sympathetic because
all about the web being the platform, right?
Sure,
but I'm sorry,
absolutely.
But and that's what Google's focus is. And if you want to live in that world, which you know Nolan seems to, that's you go talk to the Google guys because that's what they care about. But Apple, you know. We want to make the Apple wants to make the web the best experience in Safari and iOS and OS X. That doesn't mean that everything is the web, because frankly, that's a stupid strategy. It's like saying everything is native too. I've went on and on about this. Yeah. You know, it's like Jesus Christ. It's you know, people are constantly latching on to one thing. And I see this with a lot of web developers right now. They just think all the world's problems can be solved with JavaScript. I can spay my cat with JavaScript, you know, and I'm going to go out and do that. And but you can change that word with anything. You could make it C++ or Ruby or Python or Objective-C or Swift. You can't just drink from one glass there, folks. It's a stupid way to do development. Listen to this quote by a very smart man. You can tell me who said this.
English. Is it you, Don? Yeah. Are you going to quote yourself?
No. Not that. He wasn't that smart. You've got to start with a customer experience and work back toward the technology, not the other way around. Steve Jobs. Yeah. Steve said that. And that's the mistake I see people constantly make. Fixations on technology. And you know what? It's really the crux of that. It's two things. It's, you know, it's fanboy, fangirlism, and frankly, laziness. You know, I'm really familiar with how this works. I just want to do everything this way. Right?
Okay, so with that in mind, Jim, what are the particular technologies that were brought up? Because it seemed to me like cute ways to access a local database was a big one.
Post in particular. Cool. Yeah, so that post in particular was pretty fixated on IndexedDB and some of the local storage stuff, which is obviously important, particularly if you are building web applications that want to feel like native applications, whether they live in a browser or they live standalone. And there are a lot of technologies like that are sort of coming on board. Some of them are further along than others. Things like push notifications. It would be great if push notifications worked for websites in iOS, because that you know that's a lot of the reason that media companies, for instance, and I work at a media company, feel the need to have a native app. Like if we could send out push notifications and they sent you to our website in Safari, then that's one more reason that I don't necessarily need to build a native app. That doesn't work on Safari currently. And, you know, you can get conspiratorial about it and say, oh, it probably doesn't work because Apple is just trying to encourage you to build a native app, or it doesn't work because it's a huge performance hit and there's possible security issues.
Bingo.
I'm probably going to lean more towards the performance and security
issue
side of it. So, you know, like there are a lot of things like that. And there are
I just,
more wait, things
I'll
that
just
are
read
coming
off the list really quickly for the nerds at home.
Yeah, sure.
His specific complaints were service worker, web components, shadow DOM, and manifest.
Okay, let's take service workers first. Let's finally get to that. Service workers, there are several good ideas in service workers. And some of those good ideas are about improving things like persistence offline. And, you know, and it might be a better version of the app cache. You know, the app cache was fairly limited, but, you know, it's there. But let's be blunt right now. Have you guys ever looked at the spec for service workers?
Yeah, it's as far as I remember, it's background tasks, right? So notifications, sync, geofencing, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but it's overkill right now. It's way too much API. And, you know, there are ways, and each solution that it's trying to make is likely solvable in simpler ways. And I've got to be blunt right now in the current design, it might just be the perfect way to build a botnet into your browser. I mean, it's like really elaborate. I'm not sure if Google, who's the one that's proposing service workers, is really considering what the inept or malicious developers out there could do with it. Now, that said, you know, there are really good ideas there, but is Apple going to take, you know, quaff down that thing whole hog? Fuck no. I think they may adopt parts of it. Maybe they'll adopt all of it, but not until it's safe.
They're not racing to be first.
They're not racing to be first on there, and they're going to make damn sure when you go to a web page with Safari on iOS or OS 10, crazy shit is not going to happen to your computer, right? You won't be exploited, and you won't drain your battery. You know, today is like, I think, the second day of Comic-Con down in San Diego. I just talked to my sister this morning. She's down there. And the lines at Comic-Con are phenomenal. You know, 5 and 6 hours sometimes, even if you get there at like the crack of dawn. I can guarantee you the people who are going to be happy waiting in those lines, browsing on their phones, are going to be the people with iOS devices, because they're going to last that time. You know, Apple takes this really carefully, the power curve, and having a service workers API, they could just spin up all kinds of shit. You got to think about the implications before you put that API out, and you have to support it. And it's not the biggest sites out there that are asking for this stuff either. It's, you know, this is bleeding edge, right?
You know this guy, but is WebGL a good example of this as well, where it wasn't done quickly, but it was done securely?
Yeah, WebGL, better safe than sorry, basically. And no, I didn't hear that from anybody at Apple. I had like a spidey sense that that was a bad idea. So.
Oh, yeah. The whole thing about WebGL is a way of accessing essentially the OpenGL API in Safari, and or rather in a web browser, not just Safari. And the thing is, we actually had the thing implemented right in the beginning, but there was no fucking way we were going to turn it on in production.
Right. Well, it's Canvas for OpenGL, right?
Yeah. It's actually worse than that, because
Canvas draws to, I mean, it's native code at least.
Right. Yeah.
OpenGL talks to the graphics card, which is effectively another little computer.
Right.
That has the ability to screw up your real computer.
Right. And the
you don't want a Bitcoin mine on your phone?
Well, here's the thing, and it wasn't the WebKit team dragging their heels. It wasn't us thinking it was a bad idea. It was a fact that the driver team, the poor graphics guys, they were a little behind the curve in making the, and it's not like they were slacking off either. They were a little behind the curve in making the whole path for OpenGL robust enough. There wasn't the separation there, where if something, you know, went off the rails, it wasn't going to bring the whole system down. And it was just, you know, Adele Peterson went in desperately trying to get approval for this, because she was leading that effort. She leads the mobile Safari team now, but she was leading that effort at that time in WebKit. And we got the smackdown on it because we couldn't prove that it was truly safe. Microsoft actually had us a little bit of a disadvantage there with their current architecture for the drivers, because you could get more safety on the Windows platform with that stuff. But they hadn't exactly solved every problem by then either, which people sort of proved by doing some exploits with it when it was turned on. So, you know, you can't, you, if you go out there and you have a phone that, you know, it becomes a zombie or, and tries to eat your brain, you know, it's not really good. People don't like that, right? So you don't take risks like that when you're not sure. And that's why it took a while for WebGL to go in. And that's probably why it's going to take a while for service workers and WebRTC and stuff to, you know, to go in. Apple wants to make sure. And in the meantime, you know, of course, everybody thinks they're sitting on their hands. I think here's an example. Adam Robin, who used to be on the Safari and WebKit team, he moved over to GitHub several years ago. I think it was yesterday morning he put out a tweet, and I favored it and retweeted and stuff like this. Where Adam says, CSS spinner CPU usage on OS X, and he gives a link to the data. And basically, for Firefox, 23%. For Chrome, 20%. For Safari, 0%. Yeah. You know, Apple makes really damn sure that that you're not going to suck down your battery, that you're not going to get exploited by building in stupid things like Flash. You know, they are working nonstop on this. This is why, you know, your battery is going to last all day on your MacBook if you're running Safari, and good luck with that if you've got Chrome as your main browser. And you know, Apple is not
interesting about that. I've seen this a couple of times. Don.
No, go.
I was going to say is Apple is not, by the way, Safari, the Safari team is not, they're not using private APIs. They're not using, you know, back channel communication to this. They're just fucking measuring and iterating with what's out there to the public. This is not special stuff, right? So anyway, sorry, I interrupted you, Jim.
No. I was interrupting you. I think the point that you were making there, I think that's interesting. And I've seen this in a couple of places. One of them was in that Safari's the new IE post. This notion of evergreen browsers. And I've seen it, where did I see it most recently? Oh, when Google was announcing the web version of their, what's their flat interface thing called?
Yeah.
Material Design, right? So they recently launched a web version of Material Design, right? And it's called Material Design Lite, I think. And it looks neat, and it's kind of like it's a very, very nice, flat version of Bootstrap or something like that. You know, it lets you quickly set up if you wanted to build a dashboard or something like that. But in the release notes, it mentioned something, and it was almost kind of like a little slow burn there on the side. You know, works great in evergreen browsers like Firefox and Chrome and works okay in Safari too. And what was interesting to me about that was this notion of evergreen browsers, and I think what people mean by that are browsers that are sort of constantly updating themselves. I think, you know, Firefox is up to version 47 now or whatever it is, that every 2 weeks you've got a new version that's coming out. I'm curious if that's a thing, and this I think was the crux of that original.
I'm so glad you brought this
post.
Up. Yeah.
Well, you know, described it. Is that a thing that users want? Is that a thing that developers even want?
Well, yeah, but it's a meaningless question in a way. Nolan described it as the glacial release cycle of Safari.
Right.
And this is the stupidest thing to have to explain this, because it should be fucking obvious why it's that way and why Safari doesn't do what Firefox and Chrome do. And frankly, neither does IE, because they're not crazy either. WebKit is a system framework for both iOS and OS X. It's a system framework. It's used by fucking everything in the system. There are apps that are built, you know, at their core, you know, they're native apps, but they're using WebKit in there. It's used in Mail. You just can't go breaking Mail and all these other things with these constant changes. it is
nobody
can
ever make man.
Curve. Yeah. Well, no, seriously. I mean,
I'm kidding.
We did it once, and boy, Steve was about to have my ass because, you know, he lived in mail. He did not like that. And other browsers, except for maybe Microsoft, don't have this responsibility. And please don't get me started on, Chrome on Android. Well, nobody fucking updates that thing. You know?
Believe me, Dom, we don't want to get you started.
Yeah. That's why it's that way. So, you know, grow up and pay attention. The other browsers, they're their own fiefdom there running on your machine. Yeah. I mean, Mozilla
does go back to that question of incentives, I think. You know, like Apple's incentives are aligned with their users. Web developers are saying, like, oh, we came up with a spec for this. It's implemented in Chrome. I can't believe I can't use this everywhere now. Well, like, let's maybe slow our roll a little bit. And again, I sympathize. I'm a web developer. There are a lot of cool things that are coming that I want to be able to use. And I remember the dark days of IE6 stagnating for years and years and years. But, you know, it takes me weeks, if not months, to learn about any of these new things. Like, by the time it gets implemented in Chrome, like, that's about how long it takes me to be comfortable enough to actually releasing it.
Right.
Well, maybe it's not like you can just, sorry, young kid web developers out there who think that I don't know my stuff.
And, well,
by the way, let me be clear on this. Chrome, that's a perfectly valid strategy. Mozilla, that's a perfectly valid strategy. That's fine. They can do things like that, and it's not necessarily stupid or bad. I'm not doing an evaluation that way. What I get pissed off about is, well, they did it, so Safari has to do it, and they're just slacking off and lagging behind. Well, fuck you, you know. It's,
well, like, I think the different
strategy.
Well, I think the difference is that to some observers, what you're saying sounds like an excuse. And I personally disagree because I'm on board with it being a different strategy because there's different requirements and incentives for the company. But I think that certainly this piece underscores like an opinion that maybe Apple is a little bit slow on these things.
Yeah, it's what I call uninformed opinion.
Well, yeah, let me ask this. Well, this is maybe an obvious question, but let's say the big web authorities or like Google because of Chrome and maybe Mozilla because their ad incentive is too, they came together and said, we're proposing this new standard for persistent beacons in browsers where everything would just automatically be tracked. And, you know, it just built that right into the web standard. And Apple said, this is totally against everything we believe in. We're not implementing it. Would Apple be wrong if a lot of other browser vendors thought it was a good idea? Or is it possible that different vendors can have different priorities and different sort of ideas of where the web should be going, sort of different directions rather than different velocities?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's fine. And that was the philosophy with vendors. And when we can agree, we should agree. And when we're different, that's okay. It doesn't have to be exactly the same. Or why would we do different engines and different products in the first place? And like I said, what I grow tiresome with is somebody continually projecting the Google and Mozilla worldviews on top of Apple and WebKit. You know, don't be a dick, right? You know, please stop that.
Unless you're on a podcast, in which case it's entertaining.
Not 100% pure dick.
I'm not saying that Google and Mozilla's strategy is wrong. What I'm saying is it's good their strategy. You know, it's good for them because Google is pushing Chrome OS and they want to do installable web apps because that's what they see their future is, and you know, how they can sell more ads and stuff like that. Because they're an advertising company.
Yeah.
And you know. And Apple doesn't see it that way because, let's be blunt, they're a hardware company.
Yeah. I mean, so this piece seemed to me very much to be, I don't know. I mean, he seems like a nice enough guy in retrospect. but it seemed to be a demand, and
a demand is dickish.
I'm putting pillows on either side of that word because you know.
It's not a demand so much as just a frustration.
Yeah. Okay, it was a frustration that web apps could not be as expressive.
Why do I have to do touch events and pointer events? It'd be so much easier for me if I could just do pointer events.
Sure.
That one.
Well, but this is like someone who's developing for the web every day. That's annoying to them that they have to do both.
Yeah, and I agree. But, you know, hey.
But somebody builds a wrapper around that. You use the wrapper and you go on with your life.
Right. So, Jim, just to get Don to stop talking for a minute here.
I love listening.
I know. And he's great. In that list, in that laundry list of technologies,
right,
that were what appealed to you, because you this particular episode was your idea. You got a little bit of a fire in your gut.
You know, well, so I come at this from the perspective of a web developer, but also someone who's a bit of an Apple partisan, and someone who's also I understood where some of those frustrations were coming from, and can sympathize with them, even if I don't necessarily agree with the prescription, which is that Safari should become an evergreen browser that gets updated every 3 weeks.
I hate the word evergreen. And, by the way, that's
it feels wrong. I think it's the wrong word.
Well,
to
instead,
use, frankly. I think,
instead,
you know,
what Safari is it's the global warming browser, right? That's the kind of shit that drives me crazy. Sorry, Jim. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. And you know, the things that I think that are interesting, and again, my perspective is somebody who works for a media company, and so I'm not super excited about things like WebGL because I don't necessarily need GL. You know, I'm not. I looked at what Flipboard did with the canvas, with their canvas rendering of the web version of their browser, and I was like, that's a really neat demo. I don't understand how that makes the product any better. I've got a pretty old school perspective on what the web is and maybe even kind of what it should continue to be, which is a really fantastic medium for putting up text and video and audio. And I'm not as excited as maybe even I once was about trying to make web pages mimic native apps, whether that's on mobile or on a desktop. So, you know, a lot of those things.
Thank you,
like,
sir.
Well, it would be great. Like web workers seems like a great idea. And the idea of being able to do essentially sort of like multi-threaded processing in the background. And I could even see how that would be a great idea. And push notifications are definitely something that would be near and dear to my heart, because that would be one more reason why a lot of magazine and newspaper apps and those sorts of things wouldn't necessarily need to be apps. And, you know, I'm kind of on the record as saying, I don't necessarily think media companies should continue to build native apps. I think that the way the world is going is that we need to refocus our effort on building highly performant web pages that live inside of apps, that live inside of the apps that our users are using. And increasingly, that's places like Facebook, Twitter. This new Apple News thing that's coming is super interesting, and I'm excited to see the format that Apple introduces, because I think that's going to be an opportunity to put our stories in places that our users are already living.
Like you'll render your content in there, Marco.
Absolutely. Basically. Yeah. I think we should be all over that. But you know, like, and there's this side conversation that's happening around all of this that really got kicked into gear about a month or so ago when Brendan Eich, who is the guy that invented JavaScript, in a week.
Nice man, by the way.
And, you know, I think that he's a very smart dude. And I think that the story of how JavaScript invented and how it came to be, apocryphal though it may be, is certainly interesting. I think that there is there's sort of a movement afoot, and I think it was Brendan who coined this phrase WebAssembly, which is to essentially use JavaScript as a new target language for higher level languages to compile to. I think that's super interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, to spay your cats with. I think it's super interesting. I feel like I've heard this story before. Flash is probably, you know, like 15 years ago, it was Java. 5 to 10 years ago, Flash was going to be that universal runtime. Like, when the world changes in ways that Adobe didn't anticipate, you know, Adobe obviously, I think there were people at Adobe who very much anticipated the rise of mobile, but those people weren't building or did not anticipate enough or didn't make the argument well enough internally that Flash needed to be there when mobile happened. And so when mobile did happen and Flash sucked on mobile, then the world changed, and what they thought was going to be the universal runtime there ended up being HTML5 and CSS and JavaScript.
Yeah, and they ended up running the watch. So
yeah, right, exactly. and so now
I'm,
you know,
I'm kidding. It's not an actual shot at Kevin and what's his name.
But no, he even when he was running Flash, by the way, he was a really nice guy.
So, he seems like, but, a, and he just come. He seemed like a company.
In a very difficult,
yeah, company guy. Yeah,
exactly.
Anyway, sorry.
So you know, there's a lot of excitement around this WebAssembly stuff, transpiling, cross compiling. A lot of talk about we finally have the universal runtime. Again, I feel like I've heard this before. I'm excited about it. I'm going to continue to watch it. I'm going to continue to watch all of these high level languages like ClojureScript and Elm that are coming up that are compiling down to JavaScript that's increasingly getting better and more efficient. I'm going to continue to be skeptical about it too. And I'm going to continue to continue to make web pages that work in mobile Safari.
Yeah, because guess what? That's where the money is. To go back to a couple of early points, and then I wanted to talk about the WebAssembly a little bit, is that for the things that you like, you know, push notifications, things like that, I'm sure those eventually are going to come to not only mobile Safari. Some of those are already, you can do some of that stuff already with OS X and things like that. But Apple is going to be very judicious about these things to make sure the, like I said before, the crazy shit doesn't happen to you when you run Safari, because it's got a lot of users and it doesn't want to piss them off. And
right.
There are so many things about service workers that could be abused. And, you know, Apple is engaging Google and saying, okay, you know, what are the most important parts of this right now? What are the parts that we can do that make sense? How do we, you know, can we make, you know, they constantly ask, you know, it's like Laurence Olivier's line to Dustin Hoffman in Marathon Man, is it safe? You know, that's not really. But, you know, you have to ask that question. Is it safe to do that? And I think progress will be made. Is it going to be in the time frame that all the people who want to live in the edge live? No. But frankly, users couldn't give a shit, right? You know, they just want their web browser to work, to go to their big sites, and they don't want it to drain their battery. So, hey. The other thing to keep in mind is that this philosophy, this approach, Apple is not the only one out there doing this. I mean, it's not Apple against the world, you know, being pigheaded with this stupid idea. Microsoft is doing the same thing. They're not implementing a lot of this stuff either. I mean, hell, for example, with IndexedDB, Microsoft did a better job of it, I think, than Apple did when they implemented it, but they didn't implement the whole thing. They implemented just a subset of it. Just enough, I suspect, to get a few key sites out there working. Apple, and they've taken the mea culpa for this. They should have just closed off parts of that API and not relied on the current, you know, open source test suite on it to validate it, because boy, was that crap.
Wait, doesn't Apple have MySQL web?
WebSQL, yeah. They have WebSQL, and you know, they were one of the pioneers on that too. So,
so am I crazy? How many ways to access a database do you need?
Like, well, you know, this,
because it seemed like three out of the things that this guy was complaining about seemed to be like better ways to access a database.
Well,
and no, to me,
I mean, that's the problem with universal runtimes is that you need them to be the same everywhere.
Right.
And so, and that's, you know, Safari's version is one, IE's is another, and Chrome's is a different one. And so then you either need to write a layer on top of that that can talk to all of those things, or you need to write your code three different ways, or you only need to target one of those platforms.
Yeah, or like the lowest common denominator, which,
right,
I guess to him felt dirty, but okay.
Yeah, but well, again, he has... He's and it's not wrong to have this. He has the, you know, the Google Mozilla worldview about the way the web should be.
Yeah, we should stop saying him because it's, I don't think it's him. It's
Oh, it's a lot of people out there who do this.
Exactly.
But yeah, I think his.
I think this is a flashpoint
for this kind of. Yeah.
You got to hand the guy some courage for going out there and sticking his neck out doing that.
And he seems like a super nice guy. So
yeah, he really is. Talking to him on Twitter, Nolan's a nice guy, and you know, I'm taking jabs at him directly and indirectly.
It's not, but it's mostly the idea.
It's his argument. It's not him personally.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's the argument. It's not him personally. And
Nolan, find any of us. We'll buy you a drink. Don't worry about it.
I will totally buy the man a drink, and I won't punch him afterwards either. Because boy, do I like drinking.
The rest of us is getting punched.
So the thing is, to get you back to your point about the database, yes, and it's kind of clumsy that it's that way, but this is the way the web evolves. The thing that really kills you is having to support all of those first versions you do of things, you know, for ad infinitum. But hey, you know, there are worse things in HTML and CSS than that.
So it seems to me, I would, and they've asked me to run the show, Don, since you left. You know, they're begging me. They're begging me to run the show.
Everything is OpenGL now.
Exactly. Screw it all. It's all Objective-C. Standards like HTML and CSS, push those hard and try to get something like WebAssembly. And that would be my focus. Five different ways of accessing a database would not be my focus. That those to me seem like incremental gains at best. And why make an incremental gain when you can apply your resources to making a bigger leap, which I believe, and I know that it's like a different way to spay your cat, but WebAssembly seems to me to be like the next actually big thing for the web itself.
Yeah, I want to see. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm not saying it's a good idea. And I'm not saying that Apple won't do it, because I'm not a spokesman for Apple. I haven't worked there in three years.
I don't mean to.
So what I was getting back is to, and I'm sure Apple's going to evaluate it like everything else, and they're not going to work. Look at the JavaScript engine that Apple has right now, the way it's structured. You've talked about this at length. Hell, you probably know more about it than I do. I mean, it's fantastic. It's the best thing out there, I think. And, you know, they've taken that same technology and applied it to things like CSS, too. I mean, Apple's the one out there with a CSS JIT. Do people even realize that? And how much that is saving style resolution on sites that really matter? And, you know, this is, and I'm sure the Chrome team is aggravated, because it's not something that the V8 engine can do, based on the way that it's designed. I think that the next people who may try the stunt is probably the Mozilla folks. So there's a lot of things out there that Apple is doing to make the experience of running a really large, complicated website faster. And I'm sure they're going to explore the WebAssembly stuff, because they've got people on that committee discussing that. So why wouldn't they do that?
And you made earlier you mentioned that the simple spinner CSS test took zero CPU on Safari, and around 20% on other browsers. It sounds silly, but the fact that it could take no time at all correct, because it shouldn't take any time, and yeah. B, that's kind of impressive that you're doing that entirely with CSS. Like, something smart has happened behind the scenes there.
Well, you're taking it straight to the GPU. You're the Webby right. team just tries to, you know, Dean Jackson and other people over there, they try to just leverage the shit out of the GPU as much as they can. And, you know, to get to other things, there are other good ideas out there for doing even more of this stuff, but it's weird how things evolve. Do any of you know what CSS sticky positioning is?
Oh, I do. You know,
yeah, but of course Jim knows what it is. Why don't you explain, and I'll tell a little backstory on that.
Well, I love sticky positioning, and what it lets you do is set up web pages that behave like list views in iOS. So,
bingo.
You know, let's say you've got a list of addresses in iOS, and each one of them has a little header that is a letter of the alphabet, A, B, C. So as you're scrolling, that header sticks until you get to the B, and then the B pushes the A out of the way. It used to be that in order to do that, you had to write some sort of ugly JavaScript that watched the scroll position and was not terribly performant. And people have made a million jQuery plugins to do this stuff, and right. they're all problematic in various ways, particularly on mobile.
But now you can do it declaratively.
And now it's a CSS
right?
class. Right, yeah. exactly. Like,
and
one
not only
CSS
can you do
class.
It declaratively, you can optimize the shit out of it with clipping and other things like that, which was a lot harder to do with JavaScript.
Yeah.
So this is a great idea, and Apple was trying to solve a problem because web developers, you know, those people they never fucking talk to or even listen to. Again, sarcasm, right? For the CNBC folks, just have to flag that for those stupid fuckers.
Jesus Christ.
Hey, I'm retired. What do I care? Like, I'm going to use my
They're
going to
fire you from that? Retirement.
Yeah, it's like, I'll
got to go back to work, Don.
Yeah, I'll just drink more. So, So Apple, you know, does that, and it's like, that's pretty, you know, that's cool. But, you know, the pushback from, for example, from Google was it was too simple. And, you know, we need a huge, you know, we need a general purpose mechanism to do more of this stuff. And they proposed this huge web animation API and stuff like that. It's like, well, shit, you don't, you know, we don't need a whole other big thing out there just to solve that problem. Let's do something incremental. And, you know, in the meantime, we can talk about the web animation API. And I'm not saying it's a bad API, but it's like, you don't need a battleship gun when all you needed was like a...
All you need is a pistol?
Yeah, all you need is a pistol, right?
You're being a very violent man today.
Yeah, so it's like, it's a little crazy that way with going back and forth with these things. Now, that said, I think there's a lot of good things about the web animation API, and that's a future direction we should go. But again, that's a difference between Apple and other vendors. You know, Apple's more willing to go incremental and solve a big problem for people that way. The same way they went with, you know, for example, App Cache in the first place, right? Well, that was a problem people were bugging them about. But do they want to create tons and tons of legacy where we don't understand the implications? We don't understand what not only for security and things like that, but do we really understand what this means for performance? So they're a lot more deliberate about these things. And in the meantime, Apple's doing all sorts of other innovations that people don't pay attention to. Like, Jim, you know what CSS regions are, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So, well, you know,
wait.
Hey, how about a little credit for
that?
How
about the rest of us? Wait, hold on.
Yeah, I don't know. Jim, what are CSS regions? I don't know.
Let's see here. Don, help me out here.
Well, it's basically a way to describe arbitrary shapes in CSS.
And okay, like you get much more compact kind of thing.
Much more complex flows, right? It's more for solving flows than paths, right? So
exactly. Yeah. Sorry.
And this goes back to Apple's priority. Like, you know, let's worry about
media. So you can
media,
float text around like an image that is not a box.
Yeah, exactly. Basically. Thanks. Yeah, exactly. Things like that. So anyway.
Yeah. If you want to do sort of multi-column layouts or sort of more complex layouts, and there are a couple of ways that people are trying to attempt to do this. Like right now with CSS, with just pure CSS, you've got floats and that's pretty much about it. We've got Flexbox, we've got regions, we've got a couple of other approaches. Adobe's been pushing a lot of these things to try to create sort of more book-like layouts.
Yeah, and good for them.
And that's one of these things that regions try to address.
And by the way, in typical WebKit pig-headed faction...
Good for Adobe is what I said.
Yeah, typical WebKit pig-headed action, you know, they completely let Adobe walk in. And well, of course WebKit's going to embrace it. That was a good idea. And it's like, say, let's make that better. I'm trying to be sarcastic again. They've worked with Adobe on these things, and there's lots of good ideas. And you know, there's totally WebKit doesn't give a shit about not invented here because you can't do that in that type of project or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Let's go back to something in the beginning.
And if you want to talk about a company that knows graphic design and layout. Adobe has it covered since forever, and they bought anybody who also knew about it.
Right, and I'm not.
So
saying,
they've got it covered. You know?
Right, and I'm not saying everything they thought was a great idea or a great way to implement.
No.
But it's like fuck. Let's engage. Let's do that.
Why not?
But let's also think about, you know, we were talking about IE6 being, you know, the epitome of the moribund Monopoly browser and, you know, no thought or innovation going in there. People tend to forget where the hell, you know, old key technologies like XML HTTP request came from. You know, Microsoft never gets enough credit for that.
Right.
And the Mozilla guys and I did too back in the early days of Safari recognized, holy shit, this is really going to take off. That's why I told Maciej Stachowiak, you get on this and, you know, get it into Safari, which
did
is why
him,
it wasn't.
Or did you type it to him in the IRC?
No, I forget.
Yelled. He could get all the way to IL6 with that voice.
That's a weird joke. Sorry.
It's a weird joke. Yeah. Yeah. So, and Maciej can agree with it.
Believe me, it makes sense, but it's a weird one.
He's not stupid, right? We recognized it early on. Like, let's get on that. And that, which is why it went in very early on. I mean, XML HTTP request has been in Safari since 1.2, since the early days. I think we started working that in 03 or whatever.
Didn't that used to be... So when Microsoft introduced it, it was a JavaScript object that was only available on IE, correct?
Yeah.
Like, is that like a... Okay.
I
and you get
so.
Like a XML HTTP request object, and then you use it to download URLs of XML.
Right, and then
why did you need that object? Why couldn't you just get?
You needed it if you wanted to update an element on the page without refreshing the entire browser. Which
exactly.
it seems. Impossible to believe that there was a web that existed like that, but you know, this was 10 years ago now, 15 probably now, I guess. But you know, it used to be that if you wanted to update, and this was all built so that Microsoft could build Outlook, a web version of Outlook,
exactly. So
if you got a new email,
it was actually the Outlook team, in fact, that came up with this.
Yeah, right. So if you got a new email, they needed to be able to update you without, you know, polling. It used to be if you wanted to do this sort of stuff, you had to set a refresh header on your page that refreshed your page every 1 second or 5 seconds or however long it was.
Remember those fun days, Jim?
Oh no, I've blanked them out. And then you know, it was an incredible innovation, and
so there's no other way to just have JavaScript grab the contents of a URL.
Not securely,
securely
a small
matters.
Packet.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and there's still, and then for a long time there were still security implications around it.
Oh, terrible
ones. From a different domain, and And yeah, all it took us a long time to get all that stuff.
All sorts of cross-site scripting stuff. And exactly. That's one of the things we, after we did the first implementation and we did, holy shit. So us and the Mozilla folks and everything else were really pushing to get a lot of that XSS stuff out of there. So it was a lot safer. And the Mozilla guys were the first ones on the outside who did an implementation of it. They beat us.
I do like that Microsoft back in the day, and I was not a fan of Windows or anything, like, but they kind of went balls out on a lot of stuff. Like, screw it, ActiveX.
Oh, I remember being
download some code and run it. Go nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I remember when IE4 came out, I thought that was genuinely interesting and exciting because, again, this was before Mozilla and before Firefox. And like, your alternatives were Netscape or Netscape. And the first three versions of IE sucked. But by the version, by the time they got to version four, it was super interesting, and they way overshot, and they started bundling it with the operating system, and they got into all kinds of trouble, and but like technically, and even IE6 was technically really impressive for its time. The problem was they didn't update it for 5
years.
Well,
that's why it stalled, right? Yeah,
right. I mean, yeah, like, I think they just kind of like, walked away, wiped their hands, and like, eh, we figured out this browser thing. Like, let's figure out something else.
Well, I mean. Don, maybe you have a different side of that
history. No, that's I think they lost their way for multiple reasons. One is that the team was, you know, redeployed on the new version of Windows. The team had made IE so great. And that's one of the reasons it languished. Because they figured they were done. They, you know, they won. They had like 90% market share.
Let's just brief backstory. You were at Netscape.
Yeah.
You started Safari. You've been doing this.
Not at Netscape. I mean, I left.
No. Yeah, well, yeah. No, I'm like jumping.
Secret history.
Yeah. Yeah. But a little bit of experience on the web, right?
Yeah.
So, but you had a lot of respect for the IE team back in the day, who basically ended up crushing Netscape.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was at Netscape. I got to watch from ground zero the boot heel come down on us. Right. Nothing really beats that, folks.
Yeah. But to be fair, a lot of that was political / business stuff. Not.
Right. And some of it was.
Not the IE team. Too, yeah, right. Well, sure. Yeah.
I mean, we did some incredibly stupid things. And, you know, the whole Mozilla project taking Netscape open source, which I was very, very involved with 331 day. I mean, that was a fucking Hail Mary like you wouldn't believe. And it didn't save Netscape, you know, from the ashes. Firefox was created from that. You know, David Hyatt and others managed to do that. But, you know, I'd worked on two different web engines at Netscape before I went to Apple. And you know, that's another reason why I don't really pay attention to a lot of this stuff now, because I've been doing this shit since 96. One of the reasons I left Apple is like, you know, I want people that are, you know, far more passionate and frankly better at it than I am in charge. And I left those people in charge, and by God, okay, that was a really good choice.
You seem very dispassionate, Don.
Yeah.
This is not.
What I get.
It's water off a duck's back with you.
Yeah, it's water off. What I get pissed off is that they're not allowed to defend themselves.
Right.
Because, you know, it's the whole Fruit Club joke again, right? So I'm outside. So, but, you know, I'm not going to get in an argument with trolls. I get an argument with you guys because I like you guys.
No. And to be fair, I don't think Nolan was being a troll.
Maybe accidentally, but...
He used a very attention-getting headline.
Yes.
Right.
And I do think it's fair to lob the occasional bomb at the richest, most successful company in the history of the world. I think maybe that's okay.
Right, but it's not fair to lob the bomb when those people can't actually, by policy, go out and say anything about it. And one of the things, one of the things you're lobbing the bomb is, well, you don't say anything. You know,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
That, one of the things I'll add is also that if you, with the problem with Apple is that everyone lobs bombs at them every day, and it becomes deafening to the point that if and when Apple does screw up, and they do occasionally screw up, you can't tell anymore because we're being told they screw up every day. So it's almost desensitizing at a point.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's yes, what you said.
Lobbing a bomb at them for not attending conferences is unfair. They can't. They don't. And
lobbing the bomb at individual developers and saying, why don't you come to conferences is unfair. I do think it's fair to say to Apple, hey, you guys are working on this incredibly important piece that relies, and we realize that you're very active in the newsletter and then the news groups and stuff like that. But, you know, maybe send a couple of developers to one of these conferences. And I do think they're loosening up a little bit. You know, there was that thing a while ago where they had some of the people that were working on some of the cloud services talk about they're using an Apache Mesos or something like that to do some of their cluster computing things. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe we'll see some more of that.
I agree.
Don made the excellent point that like it's going to be slow, and Phil Schiller being on stage is maybe not an example.
End
all be all.
But your example, Jim, is a great example of what the real glasnost is, right? And the other example I'd say is, you know, the Swift guys talking now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and, I mean, it seems to me that WebKit and the compiler group, even before Lattner, I think, were pretty talkative. Because they're both the more open source.
It got a few of them whacked, too.
Well, Lattner posting on his blog once in a while, as far as I understand, gets some calls going.
Right, right. But to go back, Jim, to your point that it's fair to ask Apple that, but you don't do it in a way like, I'm going to hold my breath and assume you guys are dicks because sure. You're not talking.
Yeah.
I mean,
you get Taylor Swift to put up you get Taylor Swift to write a blog post to Phil Schiller asking for them to attend the conference.
Well, Taylor Swift then was way more reasoned. It was like, you can't take my money. Like, I make this stuff. I don't want to give it to you for free.
Yeah.
So let's not do that. That was the most reasonable thing you could imagine. On the other side, we have this kind of thing of like, well, I want more Apple people at conferences so I can complain to them and they can tell me things that are not binding in any way. Like,
or they can't tell me things. They'll look at me and stare at me uncomfortably.
Nobody's going to make a promise to you in public. It's not going to happen. They can make you hear what you have to
say. You can get a lot of those questions answered now. If you gauge through the other channels, right? You can go on the mailing list. Yeah. You
there
can
is a web
actually talk
again.
I mean, Jesus, I watched in public, Renee, you talking to Tim Hatcher, who manages one of the groups on the WebKit team, yesterday about not only bugs, but future plans. And he said, oh, we're going to change that. Boom. Not a huge policy statement, right? Mm-hmm.
But Renee's a special case, right?
Well, no, but I went and looked. I don't want to get anyone in trouble because people do get in trouble for this. And maybe we'll edit this out. I don't know. But if you look back at some of their histories, a lot of them are very good about answering what they can answer on Twitter. And it strikes me as almost like the genius bar. Like if you go in there and you say, my fucking computer is broken. You guys are all assholes. It's out of warranty, but you better fix it anyway, or I'm going to sit here and spin. They will politely ask you to leave. But if you go up there and you say, look, this is my computer. I'm really dependent on this. Is there anything you can do to help me? They'll go out of their way to help you. And on Twitter, when I look at the people that they're answering in the question, it's just people who have trouble and they want them to have a great experience. So they take time away from the engineering work that they're doing, which is hugely important, and they help people out on Twitter. And that's remarkable to me. And instead of like writing these articles, just go on Twitter and talk to them like human beings.
Right. And exactly in the case of Tim yesterday, he wasn't like, this wasn't a huge policy thing. He was saying, oh, that's a bug. We'll fix that bug, right? We plan to restore the two little things. It was the WebKit inspector thing, right? And so you can engage with them like that and talk to them. And when they can, in which case Tim was allowed to say that, because I don't want to get him fired. I mean, hell, I hired the guy.
That
he's allowed to say that, and it's not, you know, it's not the big deal. And you can do that sometimes, or you can sometimes get, you can get an opinion out of some of them on some other technologies.
And there'll never, ever be another Vicky Murley in evangelism, but there is Jonathan Davis, who is the web technologies evangelist right now at Apple.
Yes. Yeah. Vicky and Mark Malone were one of a kind. You know, Mark had the job before Vicky, and they were both great. So looking forward to the new guy.
So. Never heard of her.
Yeah, never heard of her. We're just trolling you now.
Yeah.
No comment.
So anyway, I mean, you, like Renee says, you can talk to them, and that's, you know, that's engagement. But are you gonna get an answer? You know, Tim wouldn't answer you. Are you gonna completely implement service workers? No, he's not gonna respond to that.
You can't.
You can't say that. And you can't say
My own small, dumb little company, if somebody asks me for something that I know I've written and is committed to the main branch, I'm like, I can't comment. Like, I don't know. We may pull it. Maybe it's buggy. I don't know.
But you don't want to overpromise and underdeliver. That's good customer service.
Exactly.
Hey, Guy, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
Did you see any parallels in reading this post or in any of the stuff that we've talked to? Because there's been sort of a conversation that is perhaps maybe tangentially related to all of this stuff about what's going on with indie developers and how the App Store, particularly for indie devs, has not necessarily been everything that indie devs in particular were hoping that it could be. Where, I mean, it seems like Brent Simmons wrote that piece, and the Panic guys have commented on this, and lots of other developers have commented on this too. But it seems like, you know, 2008, 2009, 2010, there was this great hope that the App Store was going to let the small shops, the 1, 2, 5, even 15 person shops, you know, make real software that they could distribute without having to have all of the hassles of being a big company. And it seems like that just hasn't come to pass. And I'm wondering if you see any parallels with some of that conversation with the conversation about the web technology that's happening. Or am I reaching here?
You're not really reaching. You know what? It's hard all around. Is
sure.
Like the high level thing there. It seems to me that this post argued that they want to be able to have native application abilities within a web app. That said, that's not a panacea. Like, that doesn't solve your problem. That's like,
exactly. Well, it doesn't solve things like monetization. It doesn't provide in-app purchases. It doesn't, and like the App Store promised a lot of that stuff, and it turns out that like the problem isn't the App Store necessarily. The problem is like people don't want to pay for apps, or at least they don't want to pay for them on their phone.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, or you know, the Mac price points have been driven down too.
Sure. Yeah.
Well,
now the operating system's free, so why would I pay for an app?
Well, free is better than like $10. iWork used to cost $10. That was bad because people could see iWork and be like, well, this is awesome software and it's $10. Why are you charging $40? And the answer is, I'm not Apple.
But hardware subsidized.
I'm not a $1 trillion company.
Yeah, right.
Like, so I don't know if they're trillion. They're like 700 and some odd billion dollar company. We can't do that. Like, we have to charge what our time is worth and what the software is worth. So when they make it free, at least we're a different conversation at that point, right? Like, oh, Apple is giving us this nice free stuff. That's cool. Oh, and your thing is $40. That's, you know, it can be judged on its own merits, which is nice. I don't think the idea of having web apps become more like native apps is going to really ever end up helping anybody. Native apps are in their own turmoil at this point. It's hard to make money. There's a lot of apps out there. The App Store is, in some ways, it's helping in that people have the notion that they can buy, that they can get, sorry, not buy, that they can get apps now. But they expect apps, and this is a little bit weird, but they expect apps to be like web pages where they just get it. And that's it. They're done.
No scarcity, and there's such abundance that it's hard to ascribe value to it.
Right. Exactly.
You know, I feel like we're segueing into our third act here, which is how do you make money? And Renee, I feel like you have some interesting conversation points to talk about, because recently there has been a lot of conversation about how you make money on the web, and how we do that is typically with ads, and ads on the web are not a great user experience, and as John Gruber mentioned, a reckoning is coming. I'm curious like what your perspective is on that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that all of this is coming to a head. I mean, in the same month that we get basically Taylor Swift calling out Apple for not paying for music streaming, and in general, artists worrying that music streaming is going to be their income because people aren't buying songs anymore, we have developers like Brent Simmons, I mean, legendary developers, saying the it's now the age of apps, app development for fun, basically, because you can't make money on apps. And at the same time, we have services... we have this pushback on ads on the internet, and you know, how do you pay for content, because people don't find that valuable either. And there is so much music and so many apps and so many websites. It's hard to argue that, because like I mentioned, scarcity is what creates value. If you don't have a lot of something, it becomes valuable and people are willing to pay for it. But when you have approaching infinite abundance on these things, when anybody can make music and put it online immediately, distribute it immediately, when things like iOS and Android make it much easier than ever before to make apps and distribute apps, and when websites are, you know, anyone can go on Squarespace and make a website, it's really hard for people to see value there. And you sort of get what I've called before the sum of all compromises, where they will go wherever they can, and you'll sort of one ad is not making enough money, let's put two ads on, and then let's put three and four, and you make it worse, so they go other, and it's just it really is like the App Store
race.
Yeah, like the App Store, there's no trial, so people are adverse to spending money, so developers drop prices, so people don't see any value. So I mean, like it's just this horrible I don't know what to call it, a whirlpool of oblivion that we're all sort of trapped in. And the reason it came up is because
right down the toilet.
Whirlpool of oblivion.
I don't, because it feels like there's such, it's so hard to get out of its pull, but where you're going is no place. And that's, I mean, it, as a content creator, someone who's always made content in one form or another, it's terrifying. But as a consumer, I understand completely, because I go to websites, my own included, that are just not enjoyable to go to. And it's hard to see the way out of that unless there is a huge reckoning. And this sort of came up specifically for web businesses, because Apple, while they weren't spending their time making native app framework compatibilities, they were spending their time doing things like content blockers, which lets people remove whole areas of web pages, or at least it lets developers create apps that come this fall, you'll be able to download and use to remove whole parts of web pages that do things like destroy the battery life and hinder the performance through a massive abuse of JavaScript that Don was mentioning. And I wrote a long piece today on iMore to explain this, because I think how ads work on the web is a big mystery to a lot of people anyway. And basically, you use ad exchanges. Google is one of them. There's a couple others, like AppNexus, and there's a few others. And the reason you do that is because advertisers don't want to have to deal with 1,000 or 1,000,000 websites. They want to have one place to go where and let that place handle the distribution of all their ads for them. And also, it seems like if you make good ads, there was one study that said you get worse return, that, you know, like making great ads not only doesn't help you, but actually hurts you, so that you get like these really terrible non-retina dumb ads, and those get pushed down to websites like iMore, and we have no control and we have no visibility into it. You get a tag, you put that in your website, and the ad appears, and we don't get to screen them beforehand. We know nothing about them. We can set policies like don't allow autoplay video, don't allow autoplay audio, but that relies on the goodwill of the advertiser to properly mark their stuff. And sometimes accidents happen, and sometimes people are deliberately deceptive and they don't get caught. And those ads come through anyway. And then we got to try to find them. And what was it, an ad in England, an ad in America, an ad in Canada? Because they're all different. And where does the ad go to? What's the URL? And it's this horrible, soul-destroying process. And it happens almost on a daily basis. And to us, it's almost like a fire alarm every time it happens. And, you know, it's people say, why don't you do a subscription? I'm willing to pay for the content. And you just look at the numbers, and it's like, I have to pay a mortgage, and I don't want to go to a job. So I'm just going to ask each of the kids to kick in $5 a month. And it doesn't scale. The numbers, the math doesn't work. And you look at native ads, and some people hate native ads, but I'm part of the Ben Thompson group that believes that, like in television and like in radio and like on podcasts, they can be done in a way that's utterly transparent, clearly demarcated, and is beneficial to the audience. Or you do sponsorship deals, like we've done with BlackBerry and we've done with Microsoft, where they pay for a big campaign that promotes something that's of value to them. Like we recently did it for Windows apps that weren't getting maybe the attention they deserved. But all of that is a huge effort, because we have to create all the creative for that. The company has to be involved, which takes their resources away. And also, it's not a regular thing. Like maybe you don't get one this month, and then you can't just not pay people that month. So it's, I understand deeply and I care incredibly about all this, but the more I look into it, I don't know what's going to happen.
You know, Renee, I want to call you guys on the crap I was getting earlier. You sound a bit passionate about this.
I think everyone on the web cares deeply about this, because in one form or another, we all have this dream that we can make something amazing. And it's the same thing for developers, that we can make something amazing and make enough of a living through it that we can continue to make amazing things. And the options and the ways for doing that are verging towards the horrible, the non-existent, or the interfering with you actually doing the stuff that you're doing, which is whether getting like a job as a consultant or working for another company or... And people wonder why there's no answer, but I think if there was one, we would have all adopted it a long time ago for apps, for web, for everything.
Right. You know, and my worry about this is also the same usual horseshit respond to this afterwards. It's obviously the death of the web, and, you know, browsers will be gone next year, which I think you guys in your show you did last year in Debug took out that old shoe and tried wearing it around for a while. And I've heard that crap for years, and it's all horse exhaust. I think it is a problem, but it's, I think the whole advertising on the web is overblown, and you're not getting actually as much penetration as everybody thinks. I don't want to take your business model out from under you. I don't think it's quite as effective as everybody thinks, just because I really don't think advertising in any medium works all that well.
Well, for desktop web ads, you actually get paid less than you did for old print ads, even though you get much better data from it. And mobile ads, you get even less. Like I don't know the exact number, but it's incredibly less. It is jaw-droppingly less. And some people think that, oh, it should be more because it's harder to skip the ads. The ads are much more attention-getting. But people, there's a variety of reasons for it, but also people don't complete transactions on mobile. So if you have something, even if you think it's of interest to them, they see it, they're like, I'm on my phone, I just want to read this, I don't want to go, you know, to Amazon and buy this or do that thing, or I'd have to sit down and you know, go totally John Syracuse on this barbecue before I buy it. And I'm not going to do that on my phone. So it's just the ads aren't as valuable to the advertisers, and we can't change that.
Yes. And by the way, sir, yeah, you have such a way with words. Just wish I could do that.
You know,
I don't know what the solution to the problem is.
I really enjoyed your post, Renee. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No. And I have to go back and reread it now because that is some quality ranting. I was going to say.
Yeah. I thought it was a great post, and I did think you did a great job of trying to explain what the fundamental problem of advertising, particularly on the web. But this is a problem of advertising kind of in general. And I think that we're seeing what happens when, you know, media does not exist in monopolies anymore. And the internet sort of killed that idea. And like, you know, people get upset when you ask them to subscribe to something and then show them an ad, but they've been subscribing to magazines for years and years and years and didn't even think about it. And don't even think about the fact that the $50 a year doesn't even pay to print that magazine, let alone the people's salaries.
Look at a sporting event.
The stories and the pictures and everything that goes inside of it.
Right. It's now the First Citizens Bank's World Series, and they've got a logo on every sports score that they show you. And you go to the movie theater, which you paid $15 for, and they show you ads before the movie starts. And then Tony Stark is eating a Burger King burger loudly. I mean, it's just, it's pervasive.
Yeah.
Right. And like I said, I don't think any of this stuff works nearly as well as people think, and it's probably not worth all that money, but I'll say that quietly because it keeps everything going. I don't know what to do. I do know.
Well, I mean, half of the money spent on advertising is wasted. We just don't know which half.
Right. And so, here's the thing, Renee, I go to iMore every day, and even though it takes a while to load, I enjoy the site. It's on my top 10 list of sites I visit every morning. So you haven't changed my viewing habits by having the occasional
ad. We don't like it with the ads either. I don't like it on iMore or any other site. But and I thought maybe things like Safari Reader and Instapaper and Pocket would change it because people would be stripping enough ads that they would realize that they had to make better, flatter experiences. And it didn't. Maybe content blockers will do that, but it's hard for companies that are large. Maybe medium size is better. Maybe if your company is so big, you can use content as a loss leader or a break even point, and then you don't have to worry about monetizing it. And if you're super small, maybe things like sponsorships work great for you because you don't have to worry about that many people or scaling it across that many different properties or however you want to look at it. But when you're in the middle, is always really hard.
Yeah.
And it's going to be hard for a long time, I think. And I mean, we definitely, there's like anytime one of these sort of big structural changes kinds of happens, there's a mismatch where right now more people are reading stuff than ever before in the history of time. And right now more stories are being created in the form of pictures. I mean, like, you know, if you take a very expansive view of what constitutes media or content, which is a word that I hate, but, you know, like, everyone is putting things on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter. Like, this is happening more than ever in the history of time. And that's amazing and fantastic. But we have not figured out a way for people to do that beyond their own sort of personal edification or a hobby. And, you know, we're at like a mismatch in society where it's great that I can sit down and write a blog about tech and media or the Mac or cooking or whatever your hobby tends to be, but like you still have to pay a mortgage and we're not close to sort of figuring out how to close that gap just yet.
Right. But part of this, I'll be blunt, is kind of like, it's first world problems. You know, it's, I don't think it's as wildly broken as everybody, thinks it is. And I think most people on the outside, they're not giving it much thought. I think when people get annoyed with something, if it's too annoying, they stay away from it. But if it works for them, they keep using it. You know, as long as the experience is not too bad. I mean, people were going on and on about this kind of shit when I was a kid in the 60s about commercials on TV. So I don't know. These whole discussions seem like more of the same to me. As long as it doesn't get too extreme as long as the ads don't crowd out the content and the content is still worth it. And believe me, on iMore, the content is definitely worth it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's as big a problem as people think it is.
The Armageddon, Don. It's always coming, but never quite arriving.
Right. Well, you know, this is why I always tell people, you know, even about the stuff that I was ranting about today, everybody needs to calm the fuck down. You know, it's like when I hear people talk about the death of the browser any moment now, you know, that we won't be browsing the web. Because people always seem to think everything's a zero-sum game. You know, and this is the argument that I had with Gruber that, you know, that apps are the end of the web. It's like, no, they're not. Because you can have apps and you can have the web. Big fucking deal. It's a big world, right? So
does he make that argument? I don't think he does.
He has an HTTP. I think he means HTTP instead of web. It's an API that feeds an app instead of having to go to the full web.
Right. It's not going to kill the web. So,
okay.
Yeah. It's a big world. So, and like I said, it's not a zero-sum game. So, just let's not get silly.
And this is the work, right? Figuring this out is the work. And if it were as easy as putting up a website, then everybody does do that. But like that's part of why this is exciting, right? Is that we get to figure this stuff out. And I'm perhaps a little bit more pessimistic than Don about because I do think that there is going to be a reckoning and that and it's going to be pretty quick, and that I think that there are going to be some losers, and that I think that, like, you know, this middle that we were just talking about, it's going to be tough. And I think that, like, everything from like newspapers that have 30,000 circulations to your kind of hobbyist websites that were able to make a little bit of money, enough money to have a small staff, I think it's only going to continue to get harder. But I am pretty optimistic that we're going to keep working at this, and at some point we're going to figure it out. Now, does that mean that everyone is going to get to survive that? I'm a little bit more pessimistic about that.
Oh, I'm not saying that there won't be. I actually agree with you. I'm not saying that there won't be, you know, fallout and other things dying, but I just don't think it's the apocalypse.
Yeah.
You can have a reckoning, and you know, you can only shoot three people in a room of 100.
I think a tombstone. So, whenever you say reckoning, Don.
That is exactly what I had in mind. Val Kilmer using that phrase. So
I was thinking Catwoman in the latest Batman movie. You know, oh, Jesus. Reckoning is coming, and I got real confused. I was like, "Am I supposed to be turned on here?" Is this
oh god! Oh god!
Oh god! Oh god! Oh no!
I think there's going to be some fallout like that, but that's sort of like that's natural selection, BFD.
Yeah. Oh,
we won't notice it in a way when it happens, because there'll be that other thing that we're interested in, because we are the most easily distracted society that has ever lived. So, which is probably good, because you can monetize the shit out of that. So there's that. So, I don't think it's that, I don't think it's as big a deal, in that sense. I'm going to be sad if a few of my friends get, you know, whacked by that.
Lost a lot of sites already this last.
Wow. So,
like for you, Jim, because I know you do something different on the web, but it's still web-based.
Sure. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. We actually just shut down our app and are focusing just on the web. When we launched, just for background, I helped launch a media company called California Sunday, and we put out a magazine called the California Sunday Magazine. It goes up. We have a print publication, and until very recently, we had iOS and Android apps, and then we have a website now.
I went to the show. Like, you guys had a live show at some point put on.
Yeah.
I was there. Good job.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, we do a, so a lot of this, there's a live event side of our company too, that, puts on an event called Pop-Up Magazine.
Right.
And that's been, we just sold out our most recent one in 30 seconds, which we were pretty excited about. And you know, that's one of these things that I think a lot of media companies are experimenting with. It's like, okay, we got to add some more legs to this stool because, you know, subscriptions and advertising are not going to cut it. So things like live events, things like memberships, those sorts of things, I think are interesting ways of exploring how you continue to exist and how you make money and how everyone gets to go home and pay their rent and feed their kids. But you know, like we launched with some assumptions, and one of those assumptions was that people wanted an app, and they were going to download that app, and they were going to subscribe through the app, and that assumption turned out to be less true than we wanted it to be, and you know, by a huge order of magnitude, most of our traffic comes from the web, and so we need to figure out how to, and we've got a very small staff here, and so we need to figure out how to direct our resources towards that and figure out how to make that the best it could be. Now, you know, I'm not saying that we're canning the app forever. We just need to figure out what makes sense in the context of an app and then how do we make our website the best that it can be too. So, but yeah, I mean, and we're right there with you, Renee. Like, you know, we had certain assumptions when we launched and those assumptions have changed. I'll say that. And I think we're kind of in that middle with you guys. You know, we're not a small niche one person website that is all singing, all dancing. And we're also not NBC News and we're not the New York Times. And so, we have to figure out how we exist in that middle too. And it is going to be difficult and it is, it's a challenge. It's often exciting. Sometimes it wakes me up in the middle of the night trying to figure out how we make things better and how we continue to exist and put out a publication that we're really happy with.
So hard. I know there's a couple, and I don't want to make it sound like single proprietorships are the be-all end-all either, because there are some incredibly successful examples, but there are a lot of people who try to do it similarly, and yeah, that creates huge competition for a limited pool of potential sponsors, and yeah, also another example, Touch Arcade, which was, I think, the first mobile gaming site, or at least first iOS gaming site. They recently went to Patreon, to try and get crowdsourcing because video game companies don't advertise on websites anymore. They do different things. And the industry, if the industry money is gone, it's incredibly hard to run a publication. And none of that stuff looks like it's a trend. It just looks like, it doesn't look like it's a blip. It looks like it's the new normal.
Yeah.
Where are they trying to, just out of curiosity, now you may be interested, where are they trying to get eyes or push their product through then?
They're doing a lot of their, well, so the thing is that they all mostly switch to freemium models. So the app is free. So they'll do some marketing for it, but they don't have to convince you to spend money on their app anymore, which is, so that takes a lot of the value out of advertising.
I see what you mean. Well, those insidious bastards then.
it's a completely different world in many ways.
So you know the really weird thing for me, although I oddly enough I hear this from my sister who runs several websites and she's in the middle too, so she knows. I've heard the story from her. I am such a troll here because this is not my world at all. I only made the bomb. I didn't drop it.
if you knew that what you do now, you'd become a watchmaker.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. It's nice to get smacked around by you guys this way and informed. And that's actually useful. But part of the lesson of this is, and I've told other people, is creating content is that people will actually care about and go back to and actually say even afterwards that they like it is one of the hardest goddamn things in the world. I mean, it is just, it software is hard certainly, but that is, and it's a very admirable thing too. So
getting anything requires a single act of Kaiser Soze.
Yeah. Well put. Yeah, I agree with that. So, by the way, there was a point earlier, I think it was Guy was making about native and applications and whether they need that. And I was going to blip up, but I was choking on a very tasty fig cracker here at the time, so I couldn't say anything. Hopefully my munching has not disturbed any of our listeners. But I was going to say that I think most of the browsers out there, and certainly Safari and WebKit are the same way here, if there is something that can be, if there's a native feature that makes sense and that can be expressed through the browser and that can be optimized or whatever, that will certainly be done. The WebKit team has always been open to this. You know, WebGL is an example. And that's why WebAssembly is, you know, if that turns out to be really good stuff you can do, I'm sure that's the kind of thing that will be done too.
I totally agree. I mean, just recently there's been two examples. There has been Force Touch has been exposed to WebKit.
Yes. Yes.
And I forget the exact terminology, but there is a CSS selector that can select the system font, which...
Oh, yeah.
Didn't Hockenberry find that?
Yeah, Hockenberry found it. And I think he thought it was not cool. I'm kind of cool with it. Like,
why did he think it was not cool?
Here's the thing. To me, and maybe this is different for the web stuff.
It was the implementation he had a problem with, right?
Like, yeah.
It has a special prefix flag or something.
Yeah, you prefix it with the company that introduces it. Like, it's proprietary for this company. And then you make like a general extension, and then it gets rolled into the mainline. That's my OpenGL background. Maybe that doesn't map to the web, but it seems like it does. Like Apple, it was like I forget what it was, like --- Apple system font, and then like then it would use San Francisco on 10.11 and Helvetica on 10.10.
Yeah, but you know, that's the way. That's the way standards, quote unquote, start out. Sometimes you have to do those stupid prefixes or other things like that.
Okay, cool.
That's try to experiment thing. Yeah, well, we certainly
Craig wasn't
shit
really
for that. And I know the Microsoft guys.
Sorry.
Yeah, Microsoft got a lot of shit for that. I think it was a couple of years ago about something, and it was like, no, that's just the way we do things.
Do that for borders and shadows and everything for a long
time. Totally.
And tools.
I mean, Jim, you know that you've had tooling these days. This is kind of like transparent, right, Jim?
Exactly. Like I can write a border class, and I've got an auto prefixer. Is it a pre-processor or a post-processor? I can't even remember anymore because I've got so many things processed at so many different points. But, you know, you can say, like, I want a rounded corner here. And rounded corners are kind of a bad example because they're pretty well supported now. But it used to be that you had to write a WebKit or a Mozilla prefix for things like background gradients and stuff like that. And now you just run it through your SAS toolchain or whatever. You know, like nobody writes vanilla CSS anymore or vanilla JavaScript anymore. We write sort of high level abstractions, and then they get compiled down into the, you know, more machine readable versions. And if you say, I really care about old versions of WebKit or something like that, then it'll put the proper prefix in for you. You know, like our tools are largely fixing this, which is great. Yeah.
So for a rounded corner, would it ever be able to fall back to using like a bitmap?
What it falls back to is just not having a rounded corner. So,
right. Yeah.
If your browser doesn't support border radius, then you just get a square border you need to be okay with that.
There are tools and other post-processing tricks where, Guy, you can do things like that. Maybe not for rounded corners, but other things. But it's really on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
But yeah, and that
seems crazy. But
technology has it sort of evolved by necessity when we sort of revived the web back in the early part of the last decade, right? You know, when
Right. Yeah.
When WebKit and Mozilla Gecko really started taking off. And it's a good thing. And there's nothing bad about that. And if you're a content author, you hear whining every once in a while, but that's from the people who are trying to like do the handcrafted artisanal CSS, right?
Right. So, yeah.
And nobody does that anymore, do they?
Well, wasn't that the old joke that Apple.com was still coded by hand?
Yeah. Yeah.
As opposed to using like a CMS or something, or
yeah, it just like I don't know, they opened up Coda or TextEdit or something and just typed away.
Yeah,
some of the stuff that was done in the early days on Apple.com would just frighten the shit out of you. So,
you guys mentioned WebAssembly a couple times. Is that something as a native coder that you're interested in? I know some people also like fantasized about Swift being a.
You know, Guy, are you there?
I always wait till he's not there, and then I ask him questions.
I think
he's getting Skyped again.
are we talking over each other?
No.
Oh. Well, so I saw Hockenberry talking about replacing JavaScript with Swift, and maybe that happens. I'm not terribly optimistic that that will actually happen. But I do think, like, look at what Google did with Dart. Originally Dart was going to be a reference implementation of that. And it was going to be its own language. And then it didn't turn out to be. And now what they've done is turned it into one of these high level languages that compiles to JavaScript. And that seems to be a lot of the push with things like WebAssembly, I'm super interested. I'm sure someone's already started this project where you can write Swift syntax and have it compile to JavaScript, that's what CoffeeScript is doing, and that's what things like Elm and ClojureScript and some of these like super interesting high level abstractions are doing, where they're compiling down to JavaScript, and the next version, they keep changing their version. You know, it's ES7 or ES2015 or 2016 or whatever it is, but you know they're going to continue to have bytecode, or they're going to introduce these like bytecode implementations that will let you write highly efficient sort of native like code that will run very efficiently and run sort of like a native app in a browser or in something that understands how a browser works.
I got to make the perfunctory. Lauren Brichter is probably already rewriting UIKit in WebGL as we speak.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think about that, Don? Like, as somebody who obviously worked on the guts of that stuff, like what scares you about WebAssembly? What excites you about it? Or are you just like over it?
I really don't think about it day to day. Because I it's like thinking about all the other things that I was at Apple. I don't have to think about those anymore. So I lighten up. I think it's interesting to explore. What worries me a lot with a lot of these technologies, all of these things, is goes back to that thing I said in the beginning, is I unfortunately think a lot of people are making these things an end of to themselves and forgetting the whole point of why we do this development shit, is we're trying to solve a particular problem. And my big fear on WebAssembly and some of these other things is it's like it's all JavaScript all the time, and that's not necessarily something we need to be doing. So,
in that it doesn't address a problem directly, or that
right? Well, no. I mean, sometimes it's cool just to show that you did something right, that it's a great elaborate hack, and isn't this neat? But let's not get carried away with that. What problem are we actually trying to solve? Now, in WebAssembly's case, maybe there is a problem there. Is you could write in another language and compile down for the web. And even though it's JavaScript at its core that's going to run in every browser, it's not thinking that that it's all, you know, it's all JavaScript all the time. My big worry about this, though, is everybody will think, like Jim, I think you said in the beginning, that it's the common language runtime again shit. And, oh, Christ, I really don't want to go down that fucking hellhole one more time. And if that's what people want to do, I mean, like, oh God, just please grow up. I think the last podcast, you guys, I listened to it night before last, Jim, because I honestly, before we did this podcast, I've never met you in person, and I didn't talk to you before. And so I wanted to like, soon. Yeah, we'll have to fix that. In many ways, creasing our
just
livers.
Start pouring. Yeah, just start pouring now, Jim. He'll be right there.
Yeah, just start pouring. I started thinking about a nice glass of wine. And that's my thought. I think that we have to be very, very careful about this kind of things. And we have to keep our eye on the ball, that the goal is the end user and to create really cool experiences and really cool apps. I think we have to stop being so obsessive about what we're doing. But to kind of actually argue with the guy from last year who was talking about this, I think you can buy into a platform and that's okay. As long as you have to differentiate it very, very carefully. I think platforms, hardware platforms, are about the most granularity you want to do that with. If you buy into languages or you buy into a specific tool set, then you got to, you know, and that's the only thing that you're going to do, then you got to be really damn careful with that. Because that is going to wind up and bite you in the ass. And people make assumptions about this all the time. Like, you know, we wrote WebKit and C++. And I don't know how many times I've talked to people online who think, or even at Apple, who thought I was a big C++ fanatic because of that. I was like, no, you know, I didn't particularly give a shit. But, you know, the engine we started with was in C++. So, hey, and I hired a bunch of people that had C++ experience and they seemed to like it. So, hey, C++ it is. But I didn't really give a shit. You know, I've always been of the philosophy that, you know, it's like whatever works or makes sense at the time. You know, I don't really care what, you know, deal I got to make with Beelzebub to get the product out.
Some people think you're a pessimist, but you're actually a realist, Don.
Yes. Yeah, thank you. Very subtle. Very subtle again. So that's why I always tell people, I just wanted to calm the fuck down and let's get on with it and stop wringing our hands or making more work for ourselves or shaming people. This is also horrible. Shaming people into that they're not using the latest technology, which again goes back to this whole stupid Safari is the new IE thing. Well, part of the underlying point of those posts. That's just nonsense. So let's not do that again, shall we? Anyway, sorry. I'm rambling again.
But a nicer way of accessing a database would solve all of the ad problems and pretty much every other problem, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
There we go.
Okay, I got it.
Good. Nice.
Universal pants.
Maybe we should end it where we began.
Yeah. Thanks. I just wanted to settle that. Right.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Thank you, guy.
You're like Captain Picard guy. You just go places and solve problems.
Yeah, but, very much but, like Captain. You know, I would be like Captain Picard every day of the week if I could. He's just the best.
But one of the reasons I did that rant, guy, was to let you know that, you know, it's okay that you went all in on iOS and OS X. So, okay. But just be careful about going all in on Objective-C.
Too late, Don. What were you 10 years ago? Apple.
This just felt to me like a sequel to Inside Out, but we let anger prove its value to us.
Yes. And, oh, by the way, you
Lewis
saw
Lewis Black plays Don Melton.
So, totally. I'll channel. Well, you know, Renee put up that graphic. I just retweeted that and faved it because I actually had to move my head away from the microphone there for a while and laugh into my hands because who the hell is going to get that joke online? So, and I know who that is, even though I haven't actually seen the movie yet. So,
you got to see that
movie. I haven't seen. I just finally saw Mad Max Fury Road over the weekend. I mean, I haven't seen Jurassic World or the new Terminator Genesis movie, which my sister told me was, holy shit, that's the best Terminator since Judgment Day. She was really impressed with it. So I went, oh, I guess I will go see the damn thing.
Yeah. Okay. Inside Out. Go see that movie.
Yeah.
It's. I'm telling you.
As the father of a toddler, I only see them when they come to Apple TV. So,
it's a different topic.
A different show.
It's just a different world. Yeah, that's a whole different show. There you go, guys. I got to run.
Jim, where can people find you on the internet?
Let's see here. I'm Jim Ray at Twitter. I write a newish blog called Flickr Fusion at flickrfusion.com, a domain that I've held for almost 15 years now. and finally, I'm doing something with where I talk about a lot of the things that we talked about today, actually. And
I didn't know that. How were you pals? And I didn't even know that.
I just started it, and I haven't really been promoting it all that much because I'm trying to figure out what it is.
Let's change that.
Anyway, go there. And you should also, everyone should subscribe to the California Sunday Magazine at californiasunday.com, where we put together really beautiful, wonderful, compelling stories about people from the American West.
And it's the day, not the dessert, just in case you're trying to spell it.
Exactly. Yeah.
It really is beautiful. Like, you're not kidding. It's gorgeous.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate
that.
Thank
you so much, Jim.
Yeah, this has been wonderful. So we'll solve all the world's problems in our next show.
Don, what about you? Where are you located?
Just at Don Melton on Twitter. I have the website that I haven't updated in a long time, donmelton.com. But most of the time these days, I'm screwing around with my GitHub account, which is cleverly Don Melton. I like to make people search for these things. So Don Melton on GitHub. So you can see the crazy little hobbies and everything else I have there. When I'm not ranting about the web, that's the thing I like to do.
Cool. Thanks, man. I'd like to thank you for your pleasant demeanor.
Your quiet restraint.
Your calm. Your calm analytical take on things.
Yeah. It was almost Vulcan.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Your lack of emotion really moved me emotion.
You are so good. Get soup on you the next time we have dinner.